Hi, I'm Mark Brody, and this is the Friday Newscap Podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
You know, my dad was really didn't want us all crying and praying rosaries over him. He really wanted us to do something.
Madam Governor, do you have a phone? Who waits until 19 days before bankruptcy to tell anybody about it?
Stop the politics. Stop the games. We can have this supplemental passed right now, today, if we wanted to act.
Searching for who to vote for, party affiliation is an extremely valuable identifier.
I get it. I get that my position is political. What I have been trying to let people know is I think at its core, it's still nonpartisan.
Many federal employees who were illegally fired have been reinstated. More are being reinstated right now as we speak. That is our system of government, checks and balances.
I know that every one of you out there is working hard and parting with your tax dollars. You're expecting it to be used wisely, not misused and mismanaged. And I can tell you that this building is a colossal waste of money.
All this stuff you're hearing every single day is so they can give a big, giant tax cut to people who don't need a tax cut.
And with me to talk about a statewide elected Democrat looking at a potential run for Congress, finger-pointing over budget shortfalls and more, are Chuck Coughlin of High Ground. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, Mark.
And former State House Minority Leader Reginald Boulding. Reginald, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Reginald, let me start with you. Adrian Fontes sent out a note this week saying he is, quote, strongly considering a run for Raul Grijalva's congressional seat. Fontes, of course, was Maricopa County Recorder, lives in Phoenix, but is from that part of the state, was born in Nogales, I believe. Is this a surprise that he is taking such a strong look at this?
No, it's not a surprise. I mean, I think the floating, the possibility of running is just out of respect and to, the services for Mr. Grijalva. I mean, I think that there's a 100% chance that he's going to enter the race. I do think that Adelita Grijalva, Raul Grijalva's
daughter, yeah.
Pima
County Supervisor.
Pima County Supervisor. She served on the school board for 20 years there. I could see those two probably being the top two candidates running for that office.
100% chance Fontes gets in, Chuck?
Yeah, good, gone, done, despite other people telling him, why are you doing that? But I think, as Secretary of State, you make 70 grand a year. He's got two kids in high school that he's putting through to college. You know, you win that seat as a Democrat, you're a lifelong congressman, you're making 200 grand plus a year, and it's a tough job. You got to run every 2 years, but it's a Democratic safe seat.
So I'm curious about this because, Reginald, you mentioned Adelita Grijalva, and she was often mentioned as a candidate when her late father said that last year's run would be his last, obviously before he passed away. It seems like a bit of a risk for Fontes, who's, he's up in 2 years for reelection as Secretary of State, but he's leaving a current job for a congressional seat against the daughter of a member of Congress who, just died.
Yeah, I mean, this is very, reminiscent of what happened in Phoenix when, Ed Pastore passed. There's conversations about whether or not Laura Pastore would run. All of the polling suggested had she ran, she would have won. She decided not to run. Then you had, Gallego versus Mary Rose Wilcox.
Mm-hmm.
Gallego eventually won, now U.S. Senator. I think it's, in such a short amount of time to have someone with current name ID who's been down there, history, it is a risk. It is a significant risk.
So, Chuck, if you are Adrian Fontes and his advisors, what do you need to see in polling, in focus groups to feel good and feel safe about leaving his current job to run for that?
Yeah. So let's talk about the electorate. So it's a very small, it's probably 20,000 votes. That's all, that's who's going to vote.
Because of the special election.
It's special election. It's a Democratic primary in a low turnout district. So it's sort of a very, rifle shot at a particular constituency. So I agree with my colleague here that the sympathies will be with her, but she is, again, a county supervisor, there's no real narrative around that. Adrian's got a pretty big narrative that he brings to the table mm-hmm. about straightening out elections. He's from Nogales. That's a giant port of entry. He has a lot of economic credentials. He's a veteran. Dad's ranch was on the border. He's got a lot of stories to tell about his upbringing. He still owns property down there. And so I think but he's going to have a hard time. I think Daniel Hernandez is probably going to run as well.
Former state lawmaker.
Former state lawmaker, ran for Congress in the other district down there. He's going to be in the ring as well. So, you know, it's who can identify a constituency that I can turn out reliably. You would say you'd give a nose to that to Grijalva out of the sympathy vote that happens in a very quick election here. But, you know, she's going to have to raise money. She's going to have to organize herself. She's going to have to do that. Adrian will have to do that. Daniel will have to do that. Maybe Daniel and she sort of split up some of that very liberal base. Maybe there's a window there for Adrian to walk through.
In terms of name ID, I would think that Fontes certainly has it, but Adelita Grijalva, her last name ID is, I mean, that's pretty strong. Voters have been seeing that name on the ballot for two decades.
Yeah, I mean, that absolutely, right? Chuck was absolutely right when you talk about the base of the voters. I would say that the Democrats who are probably going to be voting in this, they're going to be probably more likely Democrats who tend to vote often in elections, which means that they're going to have had a voting history for Grijalva, which also means they're also going to probably know of Adrian Fontes as well. So, you know, it's going to be an interesting race. I mean, I also think if you're Fontes, you say, you know, I'll run in this race. If I lose, I'll run for Secretary of State again in 2026. I could
really
potentially see that happening.
Huh. That would probably depend on, assuming he does this, the dominoes of who Governor Hobbs appoints to replace him and whether that person chooses to run. That's a whole other conversation. Chuck, let me ask you about, speaking of Governor Hobbs, she's going to have to name a new director of the Arizona National Guard, Adjutant General. The current one is stepping down. And it seems as though this is sort of taking on the national dialogue over quote-unquote wokeness in the military. How easy or difficult do you think it'll be for the governor to get her nominee through?
Well, historically, it comes from inside the ranks, right? It historically comes from somebody that's currently serving in mm-hmm. the National Guard. Muhlbeck was one of those people, the previous one. So it usually comes with a record of service. So, I don't know, last time I checked, I didn't see a lot of wokeness going on in our National Guard unit out here. So, you know, I think she can pretty much pick and choose from somebody who's a valued public servant, veteran of the Arizona National Guard that's capable of leading it.
So, Reginald, we've seen, obviously, and we've talked about it on the show several times, sort of the trouble, I guess, the governor's had in getting her agency nominees appointed and confirmed. Do you agree with Chuck that this one might be, if not lower profile, then maybe just a little easier, assuming that she picks somebody who's already a member of the National Guard?
I think this is going to be more profile than it should be, right? I mean, you know, right now, you know, you have rising domestic deployment, you know, border tensions, disaster response. You have all of these things that are currently at play. You know, you turn on the news, you see, you know, Secretary Hesef and, you know, Trump and all of these things that are happening. This is going to be something that I do think that the legislature is going to absolutely politicize. And I think the governor has to show, you know, what her vision is for just border military readiness. All of that's going to be wrapped up into one.
Hoffman's appointed a few. He's let a few past the gates.
Jake Hoffman,
down there.
The chair of that committee.
The chairman of the committee. You know, the DOC director was last year. That could have been politicized. He's currently appointed and serving. There's others that fit that same mold. So I think she, knowing what we all know in the room right now, I think that would weigh heavily on who you're going to pick.
All right. So, Reginald, I want to ask you quickly before we go to break. We see now the three finalists to replace Senator Eva Birch and Mesa, who resigned. Anything stand out to you about the three names that are going to the County Board of Supervisors?
No, I mean, I think they're all, you know, good folks. I mean, I think that they will both, you know, all three of them, I think they'd add, you know, a uniqueness to that Democratic caucus and to that body in general. I mean, I know they all have histories of working across the aisle. So, I mean, I think, you know, each one of the candidates brings something a little bit more unique. And I think, you know, at the end of the day that, you know, I don't think that they can go wrong.
Chuck, forgive me for asking a cynical political question here. For the County Board of Supervisors, they are majority Republican. This is a swing district. Are they thinking about putting a Democrat maybe in that office who is maybe more vulnerable come next election?
Wouldn't be a bad thought there, Mark. They gave him one, too. I mean, they gave him Mr. Winkle, who's got a history as a problem with a DUI, was on the Mesa City Council and then was removed from the Mesa City Council. So they gave him one that would abide that. Now, you know, I've also seen that appointment process. They generally defer to the Democrat on the board to have a larger say in that.
Even if it's not their district.
Even if it's not their district.
Okay.
They're very collegial about that historically. And so it'll be interesting to see, given the new dynamics down on the board, there's a lot of difference and changes that have gone on down there,
yeah.
How that process works out as well.
So, Reginald, I'm going to make you sort of pine for your days in the legislature here for a minute. Probably not. Speaking of these budget issues that are sort of leading to a lot of finger pointing and a lot of harsh rhetoric at the Capitol between Republican lawmakers and the governor, the legislature did approve supplemental funding for a congregate care program in the Division of Child Safety, but still a lot of rancor over the Department of Economic Security program for the developmentally disabled. What does this say about the process potentially coming up of finding a budget for next year?
You know, this is definitely a classic, you know, power play between, you know, the executive and the legislature. And obviously right now what you're seeing is positioning for 2026, right? You know, how do you create a narrative around governor mismanagement? And that's what I think the legislature is trying to do. And I think that it comes with a significant risk, though, right? You know, when you have vulnerable populations that, you know, need support, they need immediate attention, you know, will voters see it as, you know, governor mismanagement, or will they see it as the legislature playing politics? And that is a gamble that I think that, you know, is going to be one that we'll all have to wait and look to see.
Yeah, the interesting thing here is it's obviously a Democratic governor, Republican legislature. You go back at the history here. Ducey had a lot of supplementals, and they approved, without batting an eye, a number of supplementals.
Which is a point Governor Hobbs is making.
Which she has made. The counterpoint to that, which is valid as well, is she didn't do a good job of communicating early on that this was a problem coming their way. Matt Gress, who's the former budget chair for Ducey, is now in the legislature. So he knows that. And he's been critical of the way they've been communicating on these things. So it's a little bit of it's a lot of political bluster going on. But there is some legitimate gripes on both sides.
Is it in any way, Chuck, do you think a harbinger for, I mean, obviously, these are our supplemental funding requests and needs for the current fiscal year, which runs through June 30th. Does this tell us anything about the way in which the next budget for the fiscal year starting on July 1st is going to come together, or hopefully come together?
Well, they'll do this supplemental. There's still some developmental disability money that's still hanging out there that they still have to deal with. As the governor's pointed out, they also have an overrun in the voucher program. So that's a nice shot across the bow. So yeah, it's going to be a vitriolic engagement here. This just hasn't been great. I mean, it hasn't been great from the get-go in terms of how these have been orchestrated and communicated. And minority leadership, I think, has largely been not part of this conversation, unfortunately. And the governor's been front and center on it. You know, in my view, it would be advisable to let them take a bigger role in that and use them to deflect more. But that's not the way it's been going.
Is that, to Reginald's point earlier, is that a way to maybe, if they were to take your advice, to sort of take some of the heat off the governor going into her next election?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You play it more as a third-party negotiation. Don't allow yourself to be dragged into the room instantaneously. you know, elevate your minority leadership and say, hey, they're there, go talk to them. And so that just hasn't happened.
Reginald, we saw Arizona's two U.S. senators, Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego, host a town hall about cuts to Medicaid. This seems like we saw the states, the Chamber of Commerce and other business groups this week come out saying cuts to Medicaid would be a problem for them. How big politically is this issue becoming, especially in a place like Arizona?
Well, Arizona has one of the largest Medicaid populations in the country. So when you have two, sitting U.S. senators hosting the town hall collectively together on this topic is pretty unique, I would say, right? And you can tell by the turnout, this is something that's top of mind for folks, here in Arizona. This is going to be an issue, and it's going to be one in which I think people throughout the state, they're going to tune in across party lines. You know, when you talk about people's health care, you talk about seniors, whether you're talking about, your grandmother, grandfather, or, your health care personally, it affects mm-hmm. the entire family. So, what's happening in D.C. is going to have a profound impact here in Arizona.
40% of rural Arizona is on Medicaid. That's pretty red territory out there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of veterans that are on Medicaid. There's a lot of vulnerable populations that are on Medicaid. Arizona has a really good Medicaid program traditionally through Access, mm-hmm. one of the few managed care programs in the country, and beneficial in that respect, should be better for taxpayers. And so there's a lot to say here about what we do, how we do it, and the benefits we provide, and the health of our overall healthcare industry. I mean, Governor Brewer did the expansion mm-hmm. at a point in time. The pandemic hits under Ducey. The healthcare industry is in great shape. Prior to that, the uncompensated care coming out of the recession was enormous. It was crushing hospitals. And then that has now gone away because people can be covered under Medicaid. And so, we have a healthy healthcare system that will be put at risk as a result of this.
Well, and Arizona also has that trigger law, right, Chuck?
Yeah.
If federal funding goes below a certain level, that expansion population is out.
Right. She negotiated. But the other thing people forget about Arizona is we have voted twice as a state to cover up to 100% of the federal poverty level. Obama took that to 139%, which included, tens of thousands of more people. But we, as a state, are financially responsible for covering this population up to 100% of FPL, regardless of what the feds do.
Right.
That is part of our legacy as a state. So it's not like the decks get cleared because they clear them in Washington. It becomes our obligation at 100% of FPL.
So, Reginald, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, one of the things that I'm hearing a lot is, kids care, right?
Yeah.
Making sure that, children have the ability, to go see a doctor, get the medication that they need, people with disabilities, working families. These are, critical populations here in Arizona. And, you're really creating a universe of folks who now have something that that's relatable collectively. And they have a finger that they can point toward and say, hey, like when you're making these cuts, you're directly impacting me.
I want to ask both of you, because to something Chuck said about the population in rural parts of the state that relies on Medicaid and their political leanings, typically more conservative, more Trump territory out there. Where does the rubber hit the road on this? Where if people like, is that something losing your health care? Is that something that would get MAGA voters, Trump voters, Republican voters to maybe look at this administration a little differently, Reginald? What do you think?
It's interesting, right? Because I think that, and again, some of these areas where you have, congressional members who are going to absolutely hear from their constituents that, hey, I need you to step up and fight back. I think that the congressional members could take some heat while at the same time that same voter may look at, President Trump and what's happening with Trump and Musk differently. I think that, the view of, my congressional member is not fighting for me, but Trump is actually the one fighting for me, when it's actually, the congressional member's, authority influence is not as much as it is with the president. It's going to be interesting to see.
Well, Senator Kelly said it well. I think it was in your lead up bite there. He goes, this is all a mask for a tax cut, for a trillion, a huge tax cut. for the wealthy. That's going to be the hue and cry here, is if they go after that program and then try to pass the tax cut, they're going to be like looking askance at that. That's a good leverage point for Democrats to play. But then back to your question, do you look at, you know, what other alternative is out there? And, you know, I've said this many times, the Democratic cupboard of ideas is pretty bare as to what they're offering versus, you know, just Trump's failure. I mean, we're familiar with Trump and Musk's overstepping, but what's your plan? What is your idea? And that's not really well articulated now. And so it'll be interesting to see, like in the congressional race down south, how is that narrative about what the Democratic Party is going to do develop?
Well, that's an interesting one, because that is such a strong, we were talking about the Grijalva seat.
Yeah.
That is such a strong Democratic district that probably anti-Trump would be enough to win that one, right?
But in those two, if you got Hernandez and Herb like breaking up the left base, is there an alley there to develop? And I think Democrats are hungry for leadership, you know, not just, oh, let's go pummel them. Let's go point the finger at their fault. Well, what are we doing? Why are we doing it? So I think there's a giant alleyway here, which I think everybody should pay close attention to in some of these Democratic races, is who's talking about that? Who's talking about creating, you know, Schumer just took it on the chin last week, which I thought was the righteous thing to do, because it's never a good idea to shut down the government. You get blamed. I mean, Mitch McConnell knew that, Boehner knew that, Ryan knew that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a dumb idea. And he got pummeled by the activist left because he led.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that the activist left. I think people are saying, look, you know, right now that there is an economic crisis that is here and it's looming and it will grow, right? And you can't balance budgets on the backs of working class families, children, folks with disabilities, whether we're in D.C. or here back at home in Arizona. I do think that, you know, sort of this populism idea and in conversations that's going to be happening will give folks sort of the edge. I mean, right now, Democrats, you know, they're talking about, you know, taxes and whether or not, you know, you have corporations who are receiving, you know, multiple, you know, tax breaks. But I'm not sure that's just what the public wants to hear specifically.
Back to that race down south. Is the border an economic asset? It is. And so, you know, being critical of the administration and not resolving the immigration and the trade issue and punishing Mexico with tariffs is a terrible idea for growing. I mean, there's this narrative around Democrats, the abundance narrative, which likes apologizing. It sounds like you're apologizing for making money. But, you know, is there a way to grow the economy in juxtaposition to this craziness that Trump's doing?
Interesting. All right, I'll have to leave it there. Chuck Coughlin, Reginald Boulding, thanks you both for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's biggest stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening.